Hi, I'm Dr. Mark Gold, and I'm here today with Dr. Steven Stanos, and he's the director of pain services at the Swedish Hospital in Washington State. But better than that, he's a national expert on pain assessment and pain management in general. So we might as well start on pain assessment. Like, what should a family or primary care doctor know about the assessment of pain?
Well, Mark, it's a great question. I try to simplify it as best as possible, and I think of it as, how can you do a good biopsychosocial assessment for patients? So the assessment first should be on the physical exam part and what is really the underlying cause of their pain, and then looking at what assessment tools can you use. And pain itself is not just their verbal rating scale or their visual analog scale, but measuring for anxiety, depression. We have a number of screening tools that we like to use, the GAD-7, PHQ-9 for anxiety and depression, respectively. There's pain catastrophizing tools. We also have a number of tools that help to predict aberrant behaviors for medications.
So it's a lot more than just where on a millimeter line you are in pain, like just rating your pain?
Right. It's definitely a patient's individualized kind of understanding about their own pain, and a verbal rating scale can be really good, or visual analog scale, but that's just really part of the picture. And really the psychosocial aspects really are important, because those are going to be factors in if patients develop chronic pain or if they're struggling with pain. Another tool I think is really good is the PEG, which is pain, enjoyment in life, and general activity, PEG. So we actually use that for all of our pain assessments for patients. So we never ask pain by itself. We always ask about enjoyment in life, which was more of a psychosocial aspect, and then function is their general activity. So at least patients are understanding that this is not just about their pain score, that we really want to know about their function and their quality of life.
Can you enjoy life if you have a lot of pain?
I think that's the key with pain management, is how do we help patients function better and go back to the things that they want to do? And many times it'll be important for a primary care doctor to ask those questions. A lot of times I think we mistakenly just ask what their pain score is. But I like to start a patient off at the beginning of the day. What time do you wake up? When do you take your medications? What do you do from 8 to 12 o'clock? Or walk them through the day, or have them walk through the day with you. And you'd be surprised, you can quickly pick up on those functional things that patients may not be doing, or things they're struggling to do. And then that helps you when you start to put together a better treatment plan. Or are you going to consider treating their depression or their sleep problems first before even considering an analgesic?
So that's just great. So to do a pain assessment, you have to be more than just a primary care practitioner. You have to be sensitive to the whole patient.
Correct. It's definitely, like I said, a biopsychosocial assessment. I think that way, too, you establish a better rapport with the patient. And then I think the expectations that patients have about your treatment is going to be a little more clear, because you're really talking about function from the beginning and how the pain impacts their life, just separate from the pain score.
That's great. Where does pain come from? Do we understand anything about what pain is and where it comes from?
Well, pain's complex, obviously. It's an important sensory index. Our bodies, in various ways, are there to help, you know, our pain sensation system is there to help make us aware of harm to the body. But over time, pain in itself goes beyond just being a protective mechanism, in that pain sensation can lead to other chronic issues. So I really like to think of pain as something that happens in the periphery. So you have changes at the peripheral nociceptors that are picking up that pain signal. It's taking that signal, whether it's the skin or trauma or cold or heat, and it's making that signal into electrical activity in the nociceptor in the skin, and that's causing other changes at the peripheral receptor, which then activates sodium channels, and those sodium channels actually conduct electricity all the way to the spinal cord and then to the brain. So that peripheral input is the first input to the system, and then that starts changes at the spinal cord and at the brain and how we respond to pain. So going back to the periphery, you know, many times with conditions like nociceptive pain or inflammation, there's changes in the receptor, certain chemicals are released, those channels or pathways get activated, and that receptor gets depolarized and then starts the barrage. Unfortunately, with persistent pain, even from the periphery, that input can be increased over time, and then that leads to what we call peripheral sensitization, where the threshold for firing of those receptors is lowered, and so then you're more sensitive to these pain signals. And that feeds into that kind of chronic input to the spinal cord, where there's another additional changes and up into the brain, and how we respond to pain and how we react and how we feel about it, it becomes very complex as well.
So how is it that a person who's under a lot of stress might feel more pain?
Well, definitely patients tell us a lot, and we can get that from a good interview with how anxiety or depression or stress increases their pain. If you go back to Melzack a number of years ago in the 70s, developed what's called the gait control theory, which is still kind of at the basis of what we do every day in pain management. The gait control theory talked about that pain can be modulated, or you can gate pain signals at the spinal cord level. And what the gait control theory talked about was that you could stimulate large fibers. So when you get injured, you rub your arm because of the injury. That stimulates large fibers. That stimulation of fibers causes inhibition of pain, the small fibers, which are the pain fibers at the dorsal horn. So Melzack talked a lot about, and he wasn't the first, but the first to really characterize this on a wider level, that you could modulate pain at the spinal cord level. And so again, that was by activating large fibers to inhibit small fibers or the pain fibers. What was probably most important, which got a little bit neglected, but I think we can appreciate, and getting back to your question about stress, he also talked about how the brain itself is always trying to increase descending inhibition. And so the brain at its resting state is inhibiting pain signals, and that's through different neurochemical pathways. If you have increased stress or anxiety or depression, you're losing that kind of filter. And so that's why patients report increased pain. And so it's important when you're treating a patient or assessing a patient to keep that in mind, that we're thinking about this whole gait control theory, which is not just in the periphery where the injury is, but at the spinal cord and at the brain. And so if you don't do a good assessment of their depression and anxiety, it's going to be hard to treat their pain effectively.
What did you mean when you said making a catastrophe out of pain, or pain catastrophizing?
Well, pain catastrophizing actually has been kind of very well studied in the last number of years. Patients tell us about catastrophizing in a number of ways. I like to think catastrophizing as one of those important psychosocial factors. Most people with chronic pain think of, or physicians think of, depression and anxiety, which we know are common. Catastrophizing in many patients may be just as important. Catastrophizing is kind of the idea of ruminating about the negative consequences of an activity that's going to increase your pain. And so a patient, for example, would think, well, I'm not going to take the trash out, because if I do that and walk down my driveway and pull my trash cans, it's going to increase my back pain, so I'm not going to do it. So you have these kind of maladaptive ideas about potential increases in pain. And there's been a number of studies, even with functional MRI imaging, showing if you can help decrease people's maladaptive thoughts and decrease catastrophic thinking, it can help decrease their pain. So catastrophizing has been a big area, especially with cognitive behavioral therapy interventions, mindfulness-based stress reduction also can be kind of keyed in with understanding and treating catastrophizing, anxiety, and all those other psychological factors that can increase your pain.
Do people think that they have pain and they really have a separate problem, like maybe cancer or something, and you just didn't figure it out, but deep down that there must be something that's terribly wrong with them?
Right, I mean, that's definitely, right now you're having catastrophic thoughts for me, right? Talking about, and that's a lot of patients that they may have had, they have back pain and the imaging is normal, and they're thinking that something else is wrong because I still have pain, but I'm being told that there's nothing wrong. So it's normal. Yeah, it's a conspiracy, right? It's a normal response to have those type of doubts and fears. And many patients, those fears themselves can be so exaggerated that can cause significant anxiety. And so even just education about their pain, what does that pain signal mean? What is the gait control theory? Going through the MRI and explaining to patients, even though there's all these abnormalities, that's not all contributing to your pain. So the education part is important, because if patients have the wrong information, that's going to lead to maladaptive ideas and thoughts, and they're going to react the wrong way about their pain.
Well, half of it seems reasonable, but then they get carried away.
Right, and it's natural response to try to protect your body, try to decrease your pain. And I think it's important too, Mark, to remember pain is this threat to the biologic integrity of someone. Suffering is the threat to that person. So most of our patients that present to us, they're really suffering because the pain's affecting whether it's their interaction with their family members, their ability to work, it's causing these maladaptive ideas. And they may tell you it's a pain score, but it's really the suffering part. Even though it's important to ask about their pain, just it's important to remember that construct, that the suffering part is going to be important, because you can do a lot to help a patient manage their pain better and return to their function, and their suffering can go way down. Yet their pain score may not change as much.
Does that help inform us as to why depression might make their pain more painful?
Yes, I mean, pain, you know, depression, anxiety, it's interacting not just in a behavioral level, but a neurochemical level. Mm-hmm. So serotonin, norepinephrine, and I like to explain to patients a number of the chemicals that are being released or are abnormally elevated due to your pain condition are also neurochemically contributing to your depression, anxiety, and many times disturbed sleep. So mm-hmm. we kind of think of, when we're going to treat you, we're thinking of neurochemical reasons, ways to do that through medications, but also behavioral techniques, so cognitive behavioral therapy, or even exercise. Exercise in itself can change the neurochemicals in your body and help with depression and anxiety, per se. So very complex pathways, and it's just really the goal is to let the patients understand that so they can understand what your treatment goals are.
So for CBT and cognitive behavioral therapies, the goal isn't to augment the top-down inhibition of pain, it's to reduce the catastrophe reaction.
Or a combination of those things. Uh-huh. I think, you know, cognitive behavioral therapy first is identifying, are there maladaptive thoughts and ideas about pain? Is there poor coping strategies? Are there poor interactions that you have with your family members about the pain? And then the treatment part is giving patients better tools and better ways that they can maybe interact with their family better, not have as much pain behavior about their pain, understand how to control their anxiety, how to do techniques or how to do activities that are more pleasant. Many times our patients with chronic pain are depressed or they're sad and they're stopped doing the activities they like to do. So that cognitive behavioral intervention may be, how can I get you to go back to doing some of those things that you've kind of pushed aside because you've been so focused on your pain, to get you back to the activities that you like to do.
That's very interesting and helpful. You're thinking about risk stratification, and you're an expert in that. Most patients, when left to their own devices, often increase the risks because they don't know what to do. What do you do to help them manage the risks in pain and pain treatment?
Well, I think, you know, risk stratification now has become complex because we can think of risk stratification for what is your risk for developing chronic pain from mm-hmm. acute pain, for example, or we can look at it with regards to medications. If I give you an opioid for pain right. management, what is your risk for developing aberrant behaviors, or if you have a number of aberrant behaviors, potentially addiction problems or other maladaptive adverse effects from the medicine.
So let's start with the first. I mean, if you have an acute pain, what's the risk mitigation stratification to keep that from becoming a chronic pain problem?
Well, I think with looking at acute pain and developing chronic pain, the risk stratification, I think, is more in the back of the mind with the physician. Are you looking at the predictors for chronic pain? And most predictors, and this varies across conditions, whether you look at surgery or even people that develop severe low back pain, is there family history of back pain or chronic pain? Is there a history of physical or psychological abuse at an early age or recently? Many times trauma can trigger these changes in your nervous system. From a risk stratification standpoint, is there a history of depression or anxiety? Is there a history of substance misuse? Not just opioids or alcohol, any kind of substance. Those also, that previous history can make you more prone to develop chronic pain. So in general, more for acute pain, it's looking at kind of those psychosocial risk mm-hmm. factors, but then also looking at familial. Many times there is somewhat of a genetic predisposition to some of these chronic pain conditions.
So it's more a lock and a key. It's like what the person brings to the drug challenge or to the pain challenge. What's their history? Mm-hmm. What's their family history? What's their abuse history? What's their psychiatric history? All that affects the likelihood that they would move from acute to chronic.
It could, or make it harder for them to recover, let's say, from knee replacement surgery, mm-hmm. where most patients recover within a couple of months. They do well after the knee replacement. When you look at most surgical literature, a lot of the risk factors aren't actually the underlying osteoarthritis or the underlying reason why you had the surgery, but those psychosocial variables. And does that somehow predispose people to chronic pain?
Thank you so much. This has been a really great discussion, and it's nice to learn from you. I mean, you have a lot to share.
Thanks for having me.
I appreciate it.